Now, I've got Ken Hill, and I want to just kind of close it up. We might need to, you know, I want to kind of cover rules of civil procedure, and maybe we can carry out a discussion on a later occasion for other things. How did these rules that we have today get developed? Well, if you go back into Blackstone's commentaries, you know, you can see what they had back in those days. There was a procedure, much like what we have today. You know, the common law civil procedure was fairly well developed. And so over time, you know, of course, our rules have become a little bit more complex because our society has become a little bit more complex. We're no longer an agrarian society. We're a modern cosmopolitan society. But by the time you get into the 30s, there is an effort. You know, you had procedures that have been developed by the, you know, courts for hundreds of years, so that by the time you get into the 1800s, you know, now these legislative bodies are kind of memorializing these habits and customs and accepted procedures that were found in the courts. They began to memorialize them with rules that would be applicable in a certain locality like a state. But by the time you get into the 20s and 30s, there's a need to come out with, you know, something that's a little bit more uniform. And so in the 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, back during that period of time, we had the Uniform Commercial Code was being developed. And at the same time, there was an effort to memorialize and come up with some rules of procedure for the federal courts. And what we have today is the result of, over the last 70 and 80 years, of, you know, reducing the rules of procedure down to something in writing. You will now find them in the federal rules of civil procedure. Now, when the federal rules came out, you know, when I was in law school, you know, federal rules had been in effect for a, you know, a short period of time, a decade or more, in the federal courts. When I was in law school, Alabama came along and said, "Oh, hey, these federal rules look, you know, they're well developed." And so the Alabama legislature said, "Hey, we're going to come out with our own rules of civil procedure, but they're going to be patterned upon the federal rules." And so what Joe has on the screen right now is, you know, these rules of civil procedure are kind of easy to understand, and all it takes is sitting down and taking a look at them. You know, you got, like, you know, here on the screen, you know, how do you start a lawsuit? Well, rules 3 and 4 and 5 deal with those matters. You know, how do you serve somebody? You know, sit down and read them. You know, you have to have a complaint. A complaint is accompanied with a summons, and the summons and complaint are served upon the defendant. And so you have these, you know, here you have Title II on the screen, commencing an action. You know, those are the procedures that relate to that. Plus, you have these rules that relate to pleading certain matters. And so Title III, pleadings and motions, you know, those rules address that. Move down the page to Title IV, the parties. You know, there have to be some rules about, you know, who parties are, and, you know, minors, public officials, and stuff like that, and when to join defendants and when to not. So you have a section of the rules that relate to that. But then also, you know, at common law, you didn't have the rules of civil procedure didn't include things like discovery. And if you wanted to get discovery, you know, in most cases, you filed a lawsuit. You know, there's a proceedings in court to define what the issues are that are going to get tried, but you didn't have the right to get information from your opponent. If you wanted information, we call that discovery, you had to file a separate lawsuit. But what the rules of the federal rules of civil procedure did is that, hey, that's a waste of time. You know, that's You know, why do that? Let's incorporate discovery in the rules. So these rules for discovery, meaning that one party to a case can ask for questions in writing of the opponent, or you can have depositions, or you can, you know, if real property or place is real important, you can go out and inspect those. You know, you can issue interrogatories to parties. You can have a request for production of documents. That's what's called discovery. And the rules cover those. Now, Joe, let's go down to trials. You know, these are the rules regarding trials. You can see it starts in Rule 38, you know, jury trial, and, you know, the various things that happen during the course of a trial are the subject of rules. And you can sit down and, you know, I wouldn't say that, you know, a member of the public, you know, if you're interested in learning something about the law, you know, you could sit down and, you know, there may be some stuff you can see by videos on the internet. But I do not believe that, you know, an average intelligent American has any problem with looking at the rules and seeing what they provide for. And then finally, you've got another part of the rules as relates to judgments. But, you know, and all of these things, these rules of civil procedure, the federal rules, you can pull up on the internet. And you can pull up the state rules that are patterned upon the federal rules, you know, they're also on the internet. And then, you know, most states have patterned their rules of procedure based upon the federal. So, Joe, here it is. We've all already been engaged in about an hour on this. And I wanted to, maybe next week or sometime later, we can do something about criminal procedures. But I do think that it's real important for Americans to know a little bit more about law than that they really know. And I think it's, you know, I like taking this opportunity to provide information to people about something they might not know nothing about. And, you know, I think that it's real easy to understand. I think I've given a kind of a simple presentation of the history of civil and criminal trials in an hour that is something that's understandable and provides a foundation to our people that are joining us here. If they want to explore more and learn more, they can do it.
Thank you, Larry.
So here it is, almost like Joe.
Thank you. Mark had a question. I don't know, is Sean going to talk a little bit also, or...
Don't know.
Well, we'll.
I don't see him on the screen.
If he's monitoring us. Meanwhile, Mark had a question. Do you see that on the chat, Larry, or do you want me to read it to you?
Well, yeah, read it to me. I'll pull it up. Do you find that the judges are securing, protecting, providing correct, complete, and truthful instructions to the juries regarding people's rights to due process in criminal tax cases against the average American that never owe a penny? Okay. The merits of substantive law is entirely different from, you know, what goes on in court. You know, there's a need for people to understand the procedures that go on in court. And in court is where substantive law gets applied. And there's substantive tax law that gets applied when parties engage in, you know, the IRS comes along and sues somebody. You know, that's civil litigation. You're dealing with substantive law regarding a particular issue. And as we know, you know, there's civil litigation regarding taxes and there's criminal litigation regarding taxes. And I will tell you that, you know, I have differences with judges. Since this is going to be available to anybody that can download it, I think I need to be guarded about what I have to say. But I have differences with judges about, you know, how the federal tax law is to be construed. But one of the things is real important, you know, if we assert and claim that the federal tax laws are not as broad as is commonly perceived, then it's real important for those that have such views to be conversant with and understand the legal foundation for those arguments. And that's the reason why, if you go over to my website, you know, I've got the old tax acts and the old tax regulations there. And I have found in my career that, let me tell you about the, when I was in law school, my roommate, Joe Rich, was head of the law review. Who is he today? Well, you know, for decades, he has been a prominent tax lawyer here in Huntsville, Alabama. He's also, you know, he's done a lot more. He represented a lot of the, you know, we have a lot of aerospace companies around here in town. And Joe was deeply involved in, you know, dealing with their tax matters. And he was the chairman of the Tennessee Valley Authority at one time. And of course, he's, you know, laying low on practicing law right now, you know. But he was a tax lawyer. And it's been my experience that tax lawyers, you know, they go to NYU Tax School, where they're taught only the Internal Revenue Code. History, the history of the tax laws, is not something that's important. Well, I think it's real important to see the development. And that's the reason why, you know, my views of the tax laws, and which leads me to conclude that, hey, they're different from the common perception. The way I reach those conclusions is by my historical studies. And I trace the, you know, these tax laws back, and, you know, when you study them all, the history of it, and it's easy to do that because, you know, you can follow a certain procedure or a certain point of the law, you know, forward into time and reach conclusions different from people that only look at the code without that historical foundation. They'll reach a conclusion that I think is different from when you read the reach conclusions based on the historical perspective.
Larry, wouldn't it be fair to say, though, because of how you've spoken about imperii materii, that actually the law supports your way of your explanation?
Well,
about
yeah. You know, about most people, you know, like this issue of liability. And, you know, Irwin Schiff was deep into the liability. He popularized, you got to be liable. Okay. And people would only look at the current code. And, you know, I remember that people looking at the current code, it was so big. You know, they couldn't, you know, comprehend it. You know, but somehow, some way, you had to be liable. Well, when you go back into time and see the changes, like between 1913 and 1960, the changes that are made, and then from that point forward, you know, looking at an old tax act and seeing the pattern, you know, who's subject to the old taxes, and seeing how that pattern remains in force, even though you kind of expand it over time, you know, that's really important. It's really important to know that, say, like from the Revenue Act of 1918, the only party that's statutorily liable for the taxes was only engaged in crime related to foreign corporations. And that's the way it is all the way up through the 39 code. And that's the way it is in Subtitle A today. So, you know, knowing the history is real important. And you know, I've got my cat in here.
Mark asks, well, he asked the first question, but he has a clarification question. Could you please provide a definition of substantive law? You were mentioning that term before.
Well, substantive law, you know, is, you know, like when you get around to taxes, the substantive law, I use substantive different from procedural. And, you know, to me, procedural matters are things like, the procedural matters are governed by the rules. You know, how things, you know, the procedure of litigation. You know, substantive law is the law that is being applied in litigation.
So, like the tire, and when the rubber on the tire, and the rubber meets the road. Like, how does it meet the road? What actually happens when it meets the road?
Yeah.
I see. All right. Well, we haven't seen Sean or heard from him. Sean, are you still there? Because otherwise, that might be
still there.
Any other questions that anybody has? Maybe I'll quickly just go through the, another question here. Would Forrest Gump, okay, Mark's got his comedian hat on today. Would Forrest Gump have the right to have tax laws written to his comprehension level? If yes, do you find that tax laws are written so that Forrest could comprehend them without the assistance of a tax attorney? Would his only remedy be to study said rules of civil criminal procedures? That's from Mark.
Any let me make this, the rules of civil and criminal procedure govern the events of how a case proceeds. Something entirely different from the law that is to be applied to the substance of the litigation. And so the substantive tax law you'll find in the Internal Revenue Code. Now, you know, they there's this old rule that, you know, the people should be able to understand the law as written. And, you know, if they can't understand it, there's some real constitutional problems with that. But I just do not see that that's an argument that the courts are going to accept. And I'm already, you know, for decades, there's been, you know, judges that are coming along and, you know, while, you know, we have this fantasy, that's really what it is, that the law should be understood by the average citizen. And the reality is that the law has become incredibly complex. Hey, I could not understand if you went over into some field of law like telecommunications or something dealing with drugs or something like that. I couldn't understand it. I'd have to sit down and study it. And it'd take a while to study it, become, you know, just even conversant with those that work in that field on a regular basis. Now, and taxes become complex. And, you know, one of the reasons why it's complex is, you know, you got to, one reason there is complex is, you know, you have the Constitution, and the Constitution is written in general terms. And then parties have, over the decades, over the centuries, have litigated, in reference to tax, certain fundamental constitutional questions. And so now you've got cases, complicated cases, that have an effect upon, you know, that body of law, like tax. You know, you can't ignore, when you're looking at tax, you can't ignore the cases dealing with, you know, the definitions of excise tax and, you know, the definitions of direct taxes. You know, this whole history of, you know, Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust and Bruce Shaver, you know, those are foundations, and they are complex. Go read the Bruce Shaver case, and it is a complicated decision. And, you know, even a lawyer sitting down with it and reading it for the first time is going to have to sit down and study it. So I don't think that, you know, saying it's got to be converted into something that's simplistic, I don't think that's a goal that will ever be achieved.
But I guess, is it fair to say, though, that because there is a willfulness component, there's still some level of recognition in the law that you, if you have a good faith belief after studying the law, you know, that counts for something. I mean, obviously the prosecution likes to minimize or eliminate that, but because of a willfulness component, you know, if you don't stop at a stop sign, nobody cares whether you meant to or not, right? You just didn't stop and you were required to. But with the tax law,
the intent element. Willfulness is an intent element. It's the mens rea, you know, what we call, you know, most crimes require an evil intent. That's called a mens rea, or the intent element. In the tax field, it's called willfulness.
Right. Mark is, could Larry defend Forrest and win in a criminal tax trial where Forrest defends against the IRS for not filing? Because he learned from Tommy Crier that average Americans cannot be constitutionally taxed on their earnings. I think we're going to send Larry to the, did he get somebody knocking at the door? Oh, he's trying to let his cat out.
How much longer are we gonna go, Joe? I wanted to spend the night to kind of, there's a lot of basic things that people need to understand about law. I find a lot of people just have no background or knowledge of, procedures. And of course, you can talk procedures a long time. And all I did tonight was give a real quick introduction to civil and criminal procedures.
Right. Well, let's.
There's a need for us to educate people about something substantive law in reference to taxes. And what? So you've got this issue here that Mike is talking about, and let me move up. See, I guess this was Mark.
Yeah, Mike's Mark. Mike's comments the last
Marston
one.
Win in a criminal tax law. Well, a lot of people. Hey, if we don't watch out, the American people are going to be creamed. If the Democrats ever gain control of this country, the American people are going to be raped. And, hey, the Republicans might even do that. But it's real important for Americans, with what's coming down the pipe, for them to become conversant with, constitutional principles, legal principles. Like, for example, we got this whole field of, we got the last night, I didn't watch it. Last night we had the debates. And I heard that there's a lot of talk about national health care. Well, it's real important for people, most Americans, national health care. There's a debate regarding that. Well, there's also a real need for the Americans that oppose that to have some understanding of the basis of the argument to oppose it. There's constitutional questions. I don't think the federal government's power to establish a national health care system would extend only to aliens. We have, this is something that comes up in treaties. There are treaties around the world that say things like providing national health care to illegals. So where does this idea about providing health care to illegals come from? There's an international treaty-based argument there. But then if you get back into Social Security, and that's something we could talk about on one of these occasions, but I maintain, that there was an interest at the international level in the late 20s and early 30s in providing Social Security schemes. And the international community wanted countries across the world to adopt that. And of course, we had the first time Congress has attempted to adopt Social Security, that case went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, it's unconstitutional. And yet we got Social Security today. So it's real important for people to have some knowledge of this background, this whole issue of, knowing something about, where does Social Security come from? And what the Supreme Court said in that respect, you got the, in May 1935, the Supreme Court says it's unconstitutional. And then three months later, Congress comes out with a second set of Social Security legislation. It goes to the Supreme Court, but then you got to examine those cases because I think that there are holes in it. And if you want to see some of these holes over on my website, go to my memo that explains treaties. And I talk about, go back, Joe. Okay, constitutional. Oh, no, federal jurisdiction. Legal federal jurisdiction. Federal jurisdiction. And click. Now go down to treaties. And now go down to Halvering against Davis. Now that'll put us in the neighborhood. This is real important. People need to know something. And there's a lot of information in this treaty memo. And there's a, you know, this is something a lot of people don't know about. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's going on at the international level. There's a lot of federal law that is treaty implementing law. Okay, now, okay, Stuart Machine. Okay, now go back up now that we're... Here's the case I wanted people to know about. Railroad Retirement Board against Alton Railway. You know, read that. It strikes down and holds that, you know, basically Social Security was unconstitutional. Now, there is a treaty way of looking at this that I maintain is the, you know, the real basis for the Social Security programs we have in this country today. And there's other aspects of federal law, like the Administrative Procedures Act, that buttress this view about who is subject to Social Security. And it also buttresses the view about who would be subject to national health care. And I maintain, you know, that national health care is something that, you know, Congress has a very limited ability to do anything about, especially based upon the case that we just mentioned right there on the screen, Railroad Retirement Board against Alton Railway. And it's a little, perhaps we need to devote a whole program to this issue, Joe.
All right. Well,
maybe
next week or one of these weeks we'll do that. So let's go ahead and wrap this up. So everybody, just quickly, I showed it before, but Sean's website, seanoconnor.org. Larry's website, go to a search engine, type in Becraft Briefs. It'll bring up Larry's website, and then you'll end up with all this great information. I'd also like to point out that on my website, the radio show menu tab is where I put the link to the show each week if you're not on my email list. And sometimes I don't send out an email announcing the show. I didn't for today's show. So you can always come to Agent for Truth, the radio show menu item, and find the link to the Wednesday show. And then beneath, I've been a busy little beaver. I've actually posted some shows here. I'm going to post some more. Show number 20. I've got, should be a whole bunch, 22, 21, 23, bunch of them going to be posting. And also did an interview with Sherry Jackson on October 4th, and that's been posted. So as always, I encourage you to watch the videos. The more views that the videos get, the more videos I can post. I'm running very close to the 50 video limitation at Brighteon.com, where most of these videos are linked. So please, please watch the videos, and that really helps us a great deal. So with that, Larry's got some late night there. He's 2 hours ahead.
Joe, I invite our participants to come back next week, and we'll think of something to present next week. It'll be good.
Absolutely.
It'll be educational.
Very good. Well, thanks everybody for joining us, and we will see you next week. Take care.